I think if you read John 17, you realize Jesus, that's what he saw as his sole mission.
And that is the beginning of the transformation.
Jesus, the creator of the world, stoops down so low to become one of us.
Because he wasn't looking at the trauma of what happened as much as he was looking at the salvation that happened.
Tend to major in grace and minor in truth, or major in truth and minor in grace.
The future belongs to those who control the culture, and the culture belongs to those who control the conversation. So we are having the conversations you wish you could have at church to build a safe and vibrant community. This is the Oz Table Talk Podcast.
Hello everyone and welcome to Oz Table Talk. This is part 2 of our No Agenda episode on John 1 verses 1 to 18. I am here with the table with Luke, Dave and Diego. If you didn't catch the first half of this episode, I'd highly recommend that you go back and listen to part 1 before listening to this episode. If not, we just finished discussing how verses 6 to 9 connect to the light of Christ. We now continue on the second half of our discussion on verses 6 to 9, talking about John the Baptist and how he was a witness of that light, and how he shared the same message as Elijah on who is God. When you were going through that, Dave, I was thinking about John the Baptist through there, because it's talking about him in verse 6, and when you were talking about how the misunderstanding of who God was, I was linking that because in Malachi 4, it mentions that John the Baptist would come in the message of Elijah. He gives the second Elijah message. And that is, and we see on Mount Carmel, was this misunderstanding of who God was. So John had actually come to, you know, pave the way for when Christ would come and try and break down those barriers of misunderstanding which had been built up.
Isn't it interesting that, you know, right throughout scripture, I guess even throughout church culture these days, we tend to think of biblical doctrines and, you know, sermons that we listen to or Bible studies that we do, we tend to think of them as these isolated teachings that all get put together into some meaningful order that create a systematic theology or whatever it might be, whatever the objective might be. When in reality, if you were to boil it down and look at the primary concern of the Bible writers themselves, you know, in this case, John, their primary concern isn't the individual truths. Their primary concern is how you said it, Dave, you know, was, you know, what kind of person God is. Because that, if we get that right, it, you know, like Genesis 1 through 3, it's one of those things. If you get that right, then everything else flows out of that. And really, really speaking, Genesis 1 through 3, that's a case of getting God's character right. What kind of a God is he? You know, what's the origins of the world? And if we can set that up, the rest of the Bible flows out of it. But spiritual and emotional realities, you know, they are the outflow also of what kind of a God he is. And so John, what he's writing here, he's primarily dealing with the kind of person that God is, not so much the details as much as the character.
Absolutely.
Right, and so, which is probably why when we read John, we find his letters to be more of an emphasis on the character of Jesus and the divinity of Jesus and those sorts of things to sort of entice us, if you like, to believe in the person of God as he really is, rather than the letters of Paul, which tend to be more doctrinal in their structure. And I liked what you were saying, Luke, because I think we often get doctrine confused in the sense that we think it's an end in itself, when really all doctrine is really just a means to that end that you were describing, and that is to knowing God and having a personal encounter with him. That even the sanctuary, for example, you know, we treat that now as a doctrine, but that was a real experience for the Israelites in the wilderness. You know, it wasn't just a doctrine to them, but that experience for them, the reason why God designed the sanctuary and all the laws surrounding the sanctuary was for that very purpose, right? It was to educate them. It was to draw them to an understanding of who God was, not just to be another doctrine, which once we understand that doctrine, we have, you know, like Diego was pointing out, the Jews sort of felt like now we've got that, we can put that in our piggy bank as, you know, some sort of brownie points with God, this currency idea of light. No, it was an educational experience. It was to lead us to him.
Yeah, it was an object lesson. And ultimately, isn't this what it's all about? Satan, in the beginning, slandered God, and God then had to show who he truly was to set the record straight.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Mm. And I think John is really trying to set up his book, basically, or his writing in that. And I see a three-step process that he's trying to begin with. And the three words that really stick out in my mind are receive, believe, and know. And it's like he's sort of saying, well, we need to start to begin a process in order to establish a relationship with this God. And he's basically saying you have to receive him first. Once you receive him, then you can believe in him. And once you start believing in him, then you really get to know him.
You know, that's really interesting, that concept of the fact that you need to start believing before you can truly get to know him. I think that's really one of the things, the whole taste and see, you know, it's not something that we can fully understand without getting our feet wet, so to speak. We actually have to take that step into the gospel before we know exactly what it's like.
Yeah, I really appreciated a sermon I heard years and years ago, and I've used the analogy several times in teaching the kids that I teach at church. I think it was David Asherick was talking about, it might actually have been about 1 John now that I think about it, but he talked about what is a skeptic, and he shared the analogy that a skeptic is just somebody who's standing afar off, right? Observing something from a distance, right? That's what a skeptic is. Whereas if you're coming close and you're getting to know a person from, you know, that closer proximity, then obviously you're precluding yourselves from some of the misunderstandings that you could have if you were more distant. And I think that's what you're talking about, Luke. If we are skeptical toward God, if we don't take those steps toward him by choosing to believe, that precludes us, if you like, from getting to know him more closely. Mm. If we start off by believing in him, that's almost like we've taken a few steps toward him. And then when we've taken those steps toward him, we get a closer perspective as what he's like, which then draws us in further and further to get to know him.
The word there and drawing, I think I'm going to start quoting the same sermon as you, David, there. But the word there that was used was the Greek word gnosko, which is the word for know or knowledge. Yep. But the Hebrew word is yada. And really, the perspective that the Jews had about getting to know was a far more intimate experience than the Greek belief of knowledge. The Greek belief of knowledge was more of obtaining, of observing and looking at something. Like you were saying, I can see something there and I know that that is there. I was trying to think of an analogy today about this, and I guess it might sound a bit cheesy and a bit lame, but, you know, we can, if we use, you know, President Trump as an example, we know about him, don't we? We know about him, but we've heard about him, we've heard reports, we've seen him on television, and we know that he's, for a few more months, he's still currently the president, right? So we know him, but we don't really know him as such, do we? We don't really know. None of us, I don't know about you guys, but I haven't met him personally. I haven't hung out with him. I haven't spent a day with Trump.
I haven't been invited to the White House lately. So,
not in the last 4 years?
No.
I guess those who are in closer to him would know who he is and would really know what he's about. So they would know whether the claims that are made in the media are actually true or not. We don't. We just... We don't have that deep, intimate relationship with him to really know who he really is. So that's the yada experience. Mm-hmm. And it obviously goes a lot deeper than that. It goes into a very intimate level. And that's what John is trying to say to us if you really want to know who Jesus was, you really have to yada him. Mm. Yeah, you got to know him. You got to get to know him. You got to spend some time. And I guess he hung out with Jesus for quite a few years. And he really got to know who he really is. And that is the beginning of the transformation in people's lives, and in particular of John.
Unless we want to continue on that same train of thought, I have another thought that I wanted to share from verses 10 to 12. Are you happy to go there, or do you want to keep talking? Okay. So in verses 10 to 12, it's almost the same sort of thing we pointed out from verses 1 to 5 of just how low Jesus had to stoop to really be this light to the world. It says that he was in the world, and the world was made through him, and the world did not know him, right? So just appreciate that for a moment. Mm. Jesus, who made the world, came into the world, and they didn't want a bar of him, right? And so it says he came to his own, and his own did not receive him, right? And so you've got this sort of really depressing mindset. But then what it says there in verse 12, which I think is where it gives us a real lot of hope, it says, but as many as did receive him, it says, to them he gave the right to become children of God, to those who believe in his name. Mm. And I think that's such a beautiful truth, right? So Jesus, the creator of the world, stoops down so low to become one of us, to join us here on this planet that he has made, to brush aside, to leave behind some of the attributes that made him divine, made him different from us, to become one of us, and then as one of us to be rejected, and yet still, for the sake of the few, right? And it really was few in the case of Jesus, in his immediate circle, that would actually receive him. He was willing to, as Paul goes on to say in Hebrews, despise the shame and endure the cross, right? And so for the sake of those who would believe and receive him, who would then, it says, have the right to become children of God. I just think that's such a beautiful picture of God, that he would stoop so low, face a rejection, and not only face it, but be willing to go through the rejection, to endure the cross in spite of that, and to make it possible for us to be united with God in this way, that without Jesus, we would never have been able to have been.
Mm. Yeah. I would actually say that, not to sort of contradict you there, Dave, but stooping is probably, I wouldn't sort of see it as stooping as such, for the fact that God's not about being the egotistical God that some people think he may be. Mm. For him to be humble is quite natural. It's within him. That's who he is. He doesn't need to display grand power and authority. He doesn't need to prove himself in that sense. And that's where I think the devil has misunderstood the character of God. Mm. So the greatest image that we can see of God is actually God on the cross. We trivialize what the cross is so many times, but when we think about it, if we're talking about putting it into context, to have a family member or someone that you know hung on a cross, it was the most embarrassing thing ever. That it was the most shameful death only received for the lowliest of criminals. And to be put there in such a position and displayed for everyone to see, anyone but Jesus would have been quite embarrassed by that. But he was quite natural in his character, I guess you could say, in the sense that that's who he is. He doesn't, there's no ego within him, you know.
I like that.
Yeah, I like the differentiation that you put through that, Diego. The other thing that, as you were talking, stood out to me is the fact that it's one thing, like you say, you know, we diminish the, not intentionally, but, you know, we do diminish the meaning of the cross in a lot of ways, you know, without meaning to. But I was just thinking about John having written this. John was not only a contemporary, he was actually physically there. And while Jesus was on the cross, he entrusted his mother to John's care, right? So this would be, you know, not that any of us, are divine, but I mean, especially for us, you know, who know each other personally, can you imagine what it would be like if one of us was publicly executed, you know, naked, hanging on a tree? How would you be expressing that to people, you know, in 40 years' time? How would you have interpreted that and internalized what went on and expressed that? And I think it's really interesting that John, he writes about it with such grace and positivity, you know, with the language that he uses, talking about, you know, yes, that Jesus was rejected, but, you know, this whole picture of the darkness not overcoming the light and all the rest of it. He has packaged what he saw at Calvary, and he's packaged it into this beautiful meta-narrative of the gospel story. And I just think that shows a really, truly incredible amount of perception, I guess you could say, on his part, because he wasn't looking at the trauma of what happened as much as he was looking at the salvation that happened.
Mm, absolutely right. Spot on there.
Shall we go to the next section?
Considering the time, we probably should.
Start in verse 14. Actually, it was 13, wasn't it? Yeah. Which were born not of blood, nor of the will of the flesh, nor of the will of man, but of God. And the Word was made flesh and dwelt among us, and we beheld his glory, and the glory as of the only begotten of the Father, full of grace and truth. John bare witness of him and cried, saying, This was he of whom I spake. He that cometh after me is preferred before me, for he was before me. And of his fullness have all we received, and grace for grace. For the law was given by Moses, but grace and truth came by Jesus Christ. No man hath seen God at any time. The only begotten Son, which is in the bosom of the Father, he hath declared him. Or in the NIV, is in the closest relationship with the Father, has made him known.
That's really nice.
That's nice.
This is such a rich passage.
I especially liked 14. The one I initially actually went over the verses, 14 really is one of the ones I really think on, because that's the one that confirms that Christ is part of the Godhead, because it says that the Word was made flesh. And then when you tie it in with verse 1, it says that in the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. So This is one of those memory verses that I always like to turn to.
I try to teach my kids these verses, and it's really good because it's a real tongue twister. There's a lot of play on words here, so
yeah.
If you want to really trip them up. But can I just sort of point out something here? Can you imagine the claim that John is making here? So here we have a person, a man that from the province of Judah, in the empire of the Romans, coming from a backwater town, some dusty old place, son of a carpenter, claiming that he is God status.
Mm.
You know, that's usually reserved for royalty, I guess. Some kings would call themselves to be gods, or, you know, the deity was above humans. And all of a sudden, to make the claims that this man that walked on earth, who got his feet dusty, who mingled among people, all of a sudden to say that he is God. And for a Jew, I mean, the Jews believed in just the one God.
Mm.
And just to say that this is the true God, this man, this man that walked with us, that came from that little town over there in that tiny little province that some people haven't heard of. Yeah, that guy there, he's God. Not these stone-carved images or metal-shaped and wooden-carved images that you guys worship. But, yeah, he's God. And just to make that claim, that's a very bold claim.
Yes. Yep. You can see why they had such a hard time believing it.
Hmm. And thus why he fought such an uphill battle at home, right? Like, I don't know about you guys, but if you, because Diego, I know you preach, you know, so all of us here have, you know, some experience in that role. And I don't know about you guys, but do you find that the opportunities you've had to speak in places that are not your, you know, home church or hometown are always seem to be better received than when you preach at home? You know, and I don't think that's got anything to do with us or, you know, how we preach or any of those sort of things. I think it's quite simply the fact that people have an ongoing consciousness of the fact that the world is a lot bigger than their little chunk of the world. And so the likelihood of somebody coming with a rich message from outside of their bubble is a lot more likely than someone coming from inside their bubble to deliver this, you know, a profound message. And so people just naturally expect that if somebody comes from, you know, outside of their sphere of knowledge, then what they're going to share is possibly more important or more interesting or more whatever. And we all do it. We all fall victim to it. You know, we all, who's preaching this week? Oh, it's our local elder. Yeah, you know, I know him. We don't put him up on a pedestal, but, oh, you know, we've got such and such that's flown in from this other place. You know, oh, well, I better pay attention and I'm going to cancel the other thing that I've got on so I can be there for the meeting. You know, we all do that. And so you can really see why the people of Nazareth would have gone like, really? Him? Like, yeah, he's a great guy, mm-hmm. but really? You know?
Mm. Yeah.
I also think it's fascinating at the end of verse 14 that John, when he points out what divinity was like, divinity become humanity, he says that he was full of grace and truth. I really like that because, you know, I think as humans, we really struggle with having both of those qualities at the same time.
Mm.
We either tend to major in grace and minor in truth, or major in truth and minor in grace. And we have a really hard job of managing both at the same time. And yet Jesus, it says, was full of both at the same time. And I think that's such a beautiful picture of God, you know, that God doesn't major in truth as we sometimes like to depict him and doesn't really have enough grace, nor does he not care about truth and just is so graceful. Mm. He actually has this really, what's the word? It's just consistent appreciation for both qualities. And when manifested as a human among us, Jesus was able to hold those two things in tension and show people that he loved them, and yet that sin wasn't acceptable, mm-hmm. right? And he would show them that they weren't condemned in his presence. He would show them that God was sending, you know, a gift of love and grace to them through him. And yet he would remind them that they had a responsibility to fulfill as humans, and that part of fulfilling that responsibility is what was going to make their lives whole. And so I think Jesus is a really great example to us then who follow. Because, you know, we were talking about how Jesus was the light, right? And he was the light because he was the life, and the life was the light. But then later on in the Gospels, he goes on to say, you know, this is your responsibility, right? Mm-hmm. You are to be the light of the world, right? Just like the Hebrews were supposed to be the light to the Gentiles, we are to be the light of the world. And so what is the light going to be like? Well, I think here's a great example of it, you know, and I don't think John meant for this to be exhaustive, you know, but I think it's a really great example of it, you know, that we as human beings who have drawn from the well, if you like, of Jesus, of God's love, that we would be filled with grace and truth somehow simultaneously.
I think, I don't know about you guys, but I find that to be the hardest thing to do.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Just be truth, say the truth, but have grace as well and be loving about it. And I think that was the key to Jesus' ministry in his life. That's why people were drawn to him, because he could say the truth and people knew that was truth. But there was so much grace, and it was just saturated with love when he said it, that people were naturally drawn to him.
Right.
And I believe that we still do. We still, when we read his word, when we interact with him and he reveals the truth to us, it is never harsh. You know, it actually draws us near.
And it's certainly a hard example to live up to, but one we always strive for.
And just to ask this question, if you had to err on one side or the other, which one would you err on?
Oh, that's a hard one. I would like to say grace, but ask my family that. ask the people at work or the people I fight traffic with. I tend to be a person that I don't know if it's my SDA background or it is my job that I do that requires precision, but I like things to be straight, to be neat. I like things to be right. And if they're not right, I'd like to tell you that they're not right.
Yeah.
But maybe some grace could go a long way.
Mm.
It's funny, you know, because I think probably that's probably what would come, the answer that would come most naturally to all of us, because it's probably the biggest struggle that we have, you know, being grace-filled. But there are some times where I think it's easier to be full of grace than it is to be full of truth.
Mm.
You know, those hard moments when you know you should be speaking the truth in love, but you don't want to. You just want to be that grace-filled person that's willing to excuse the problem, you know.
But is that being grace-filled or is that being cowardly?
But really, you know, deep down that to really show grace in that moment, that you need to speak the truth. So, yeah. I don't know. I think it really does depend.
Yeah, you're right. There are those moments that you feel like you need to say it. And just the moment that I think most of the times that we shouldn't say so much truth and have a bit more grace, we tend to say the truth rather than the grace. And the other way around, when we have to be a bit more truthful, we'd like to go for the soft grace and just go, oh, well.
Yeah, it's a tricky balance to strike.
Well, just because of the time, I know we're approaching the end of the passage, but I just thought, just to throw it out there to you guys, any specific thoughts, like, you know, if we can start looking to wrapping up, any key ideas from the remainder of what we have?
Just that last phrase. Jesus, who was in the bosom of the Father, he has declared him. I think if you read John 17, you realize Jesus, that's what he saw as his sole mission on earth, was to declare, or you could say make manifest, the character of the Father. And in that prayer in John 17, he says, you know, I've done what you asked me to do, right? And then he says that that's what it was that he was asked to do, was to declare the character of God. And if we're going to be disciples of Jesus, following his example, then that has to be our mission too. So I think this passage gives us a really good indication of our identity as followers of Jesus, what that looks like, what God's calling is on our life. And maybe a challenge to us is, what are we declaring about God by the way that we live our lives? I know for me, that's what I'm processing just right now as we read that passage. Jesus was the Word who became flesh, and he was full of grace and truth. Am I declaring that about God, or am I actually projecting a different kind of God by the way I live my life?
You know, the question was posed in Genesis 3, whether God is who he says he is, and Jesus came to really show that. And yeah, he has called us to do the same thing. And I actually think that most people that are non-believers are actually because they don't really know the truth about God. There's a lot of misconceptions. There's a lot of lies about who God really is out there. And it's really sad to see. But if we really, like we said, if we receive him truthfully and we believe in him and that we get to know who he really is, we see the truth about him, I think it's irresistible.
Well, I think that's probably a good place for us to land the plane with this one. Diego, I just want to thank you again for making the time to join us tonight. So it's been a lot of fun. But yeah, hopefully you guys have enjoyed this episode. I know it's been on the longer side, but how can we do anything else with such a rich passage of scripture? So hope you enjoyed that. If you have enjoyed it and you can think of one of your friends who should listen to it as well, take the time now, send them a message, tell them about it and send them the link. But we will see you guys next week and we hope to be talking to Diego again sometime soon. All right. God bless you guys. And that's the end of another episode. Just before I head off, I want to encourage you to go over to our page on Facebook and also our account on Instagram and follow us there, because that is where we interact with our listeners and we would love for you to enter in and join the conversation. Also, while you're signing up, I would also recommend signing up to our mailing list on our website, oztabletalk.com.au. If you do that, you will receive our exclusive content, because occasionally we do release exclusives and they only go out to our mailing list. So I would strongly recommend you go and sign up for that. If you have a few more minutes to be one of the most amazing listeners on the planet, you can go over to iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts and leave us a review, because reviews help us to grow and they help other people to find us. So if you want to help us reach those goals, please jump in and give us a review. The final message that I'd like to leave you with is to let you know about our Patreon account. Now, Patreon is a way for creators to get paid for creating, and ultimately what we do does cost money to get us hosted and have the services that we need to run the podcast. And so if you'd like to help us do that, jump over onto patreon.com/OzTableTalk, and you can give anything from even a dollar a month upwards. But at different levels, there are different benefits, different rewards that we want to give you just to say thank you for being an amazing supporter of ours. If you can't afford that, we would just gratefully accept your prayers, because that is what our ministry runs on. And so with that, I will leave you to your day, and thank you so much for listening to this episode. We look forward to seeing you guys next week.